Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. With Donald Trump having accused the Democrat running for the U.S. Senate in Alabama of being soft on crime, we will begin with an analysis of the difference between Judge Roy Moore and the former U.S. Attorney Doug Jones in terms of their approach to law enforcement, with Moore having a record on the Alabama Supreme Court of siding with those accused of sexual crimes, while Doug Jones is famous for successfully prosecuting two Ku Klux Klansmen for the church bombing that killed four black girls, as well as convicting Eric Rudolph for the bombing of an Alabama abortion clinic, along with targeting voter fraud, drug dealers, and corrupt police. Joyce White Vance, a distinguished visiting lecturer in law at the University of Alabama School of Law, who served as the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Alabama for 8 years, and prior to that was an assistant U.S. Attorney in Birmingham, Alabama for 18 years, joins us. She will discuss the role of the fired White House strategist Steve Bannon, who was campaigning with Moore, and what it will mean for the alt-right movement and those bent on destroying the administrative state to have their candidate in the U.S. Senate, which Roy Moore alone could grind to a halt. Then we'll look into reports that Eric Prince and Oliver North are lobbying the White House to set up a private sector off-the-books alternative to the CIA as a way around what Donald Trump sees as the deep state that is out to get him. While this could be dismissed as a fantasy of the founder of the mercenary army Blackwater, if Trump were to appoint Senator Tom Cotton as head of the CIA, it could quickly become a reality. Publisher, journalist, filmmaker, and explorer Robert Young Pelton, author of License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and a former biographer of Eric Prince, joins us. Then finally, we'll speak with Chamtoli Huck, a Bangladeshi-American lawyer with Law at the Margins in New York City, about how the attempted suicide bombing at the busy Port Authority bus terminal in New York City this morning by a Bangladeshi immigrant, Nakayed Ullah, might impact the Bangladeshi community of drivers, food vendors, retail workers, and newspaper sellers. We will discuss a climate of fear and scapegoating on the rise in the Trump era, in which Muslims and Latinos have been vilified and targeted. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into reports that Eric Prince and Oliver North are lobbying the White House to set up a private sector off-the-books alternative to the CIA as a way around what Donald Trump sees as the deep state that is out to get him. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with a Bangladeshi-American lawyer about how the attempted suicide bombing in New York by a Bangladeshi immigrant might impact the Bangladeshi community. And joining us now is Joyce White Vance, distinguished visiting lecturer in law at the University of Alabama School of Law. She served as the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Alabama for 8 years under Barack Obama, and prior to that served as an assistant United States Attorney in Birmingham, Alabama for 18 years. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joyce White Vance.
Thanks for having me.
And you must know Doug Jones, right, from... He was also a U.S. attorney.
I do know Doug Jones. I worked for Doug when he was the U.S. attorney and knew him before that. Birmingham is a really small town.
So how did it strike you when President Trump said that this U.S. attorney, a colleague of yours, Doug Jones, who's running against Roy Moore for the U.S. Senate in Alabama, when he said that Doug Jones was soft on crime?
Well, that was clearly an outsider's view. The president is not from Alabama, doesn't know Alabama, doesn't know Doug Jones. And anyone who's spent time, who's lived in Alabama, knows that Doug Jones is, in fact, very tough on crime, tough on drugs, tough on violent crime. He was a U.S. attorney. He had a reputation for making the hard cases. He also focused on civil rights and protecting citizens. So the idea that someone who's not from here and doesn't know Jones's record would call him soft on crime, I don't think that that resonated with Alabama voters.
And the extent to which he is a hero, one would think so, to the African-American community down there, which is a large part of the vote. I spoke the other day with Diane McWhorter, who wrote a book about coming home to Birmingham And she's also, well, she's very close, apparently, to Doug Jones. She suggested to me that in many ways, when Doug Jones voters use the word Democrat, that's also a buzzword for black. Is that how much the Republicans see the Democratic Party in Alabama? That's actually an African-American party?
Something that I've found distressing about this race is the effort to paint people with a broad brush. And so people in Alabama are like people every place else in the world. They're complex. They're individuals. I think it would be wrong to say that everybody views Democrats as black voters, because they don't. Democrats are young, progressive, black and white professionals. Increasingly, they're Hispanics and Asians. There are certainly some folks who would like to use this old, outmoded racial animus in an effort to get people to not vote Democratic. I would say, if anything, there's been strong party identification in this race, and an effort by people in the leadership of both parties to try and preserve that strong party identification among voters.
Well, anecdotally, I've heard that there are lots of Doug Jones yard signs and not too many Roy Moore yard signs. I don't know if that tells you a lot, but what are you seeing on the ground down there, Joyce?
You know, so it's funny that you ask that. I drove down my street, which is a real long street, this morning, and there was an unbroken stretch of Doug Jones signs. And I saw one sign off to the left that said Moore on it. And I thought, wow, that's surprising. It's only the second sign that I've seen for Moore. But as I got closer, I realized what it said was no Moore. So it was actually, you know, a Doug Jones sign in a different guise. Jones is definitely winning the battle of the yard signs in this one.
So, you know, it's extraordinary to think that somebody that with his record could be in any way vilified, particularly by the President of the United States, as being soft on crime. I mean, he also, didn't he work against this Eric Rudolph, who was convicted in 2001 for bombing an Alabama abortion clinic?
Yeah, in January of 1998, Eric Rudolph bombed a women's health care clinic in Birmingham. Doug Jones did something that most U.S. attorneys don't do. Doug was on the scene of the bombing within minutes of it happening, ran the investigation from the early days, coordinated with FBI, with ATF, with state and locals, and really ran a very effective operation that quickly identified the bomber and put together a case that, although it had to be, it had to await Rudolph being brought to justice because he successfully fled, but put together an airtight case that was used to bring Rudolph to justice.
And how much was Rudolph in that kind of world of horror and ugliness that we saw marching in Charlottesville recently?
You know, hard to say. Rudolph is someone who is self-radicalized beyond the point where even right-wing Christian groups that he had belonged to and had been in and out of, beyond the point where even they were willing to claim him.
Well, the other issue then being anti-abortion, isn't that very much a part of Roy Moore's platform in running against Doug Jones? I mean, that...
I think you're exactly right. The abortion issue is very important to voters down here. But today at lunch, I heard from a friend who's a Republican that her sense is that one vote one way or the other in the Senate really won't influence the abortion issue. Roe versus Wade is the law. We are where we are. And she said to me, you know, the goal is we all want abortion to be safe, rare, and legal. Doug Jones's policies will get us a lot closer to a world where that's the case than someone like Roy Moore. And that, I think, is a very sophisticated analysis, because for values voters, ensure a world that's friendly to women and their Jones's policies are a lot closer to where they'd like their communities to be than Roy Moore, who, for instance, doesn't believe in birth control, doesn't think women should have the right to vote, certainly doesn't support health care, doesn't support reinstating the CHIP program, which is a vital link if we're going to create a world in which abortion is unnecessary.
And again, I'm speaking with Joyce White Vance, who's a distinguished visiting lecturer in law at the University of Alabama School of Law. She served as the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Alabama for 8 years under Barack Obama, and prior to that served as an Assistant United States Attorney in Birmingham for 18 years. Now, shortly after the Washington Post revealed Roy Moore's alleged behavior, particularly with a 14-year-old girl, then, of course, since then, there was the floodgates have opened with all kinds of other women coming forward and evidence that Moore himself was banned from the mall where he would go trolling, looking for high school girls. There's something very peculiar about that whole thing. And he does seem to be kind of acting in that same sort of psychological bubble that Jerry Sandusky inhabits, where there's total denial in the face of enormous amounts of evidence. But nevertheless, the first time he went public after these charges, he was at a church where he quickly dismissed the charges as a Democratic hit job and then said, let me talk about the issues. And then he went on to say, in 1963, they banned, the Supreme Court banned prayer in school. And in 1965, they gave away special rights. Well, if those are his two priorities, the latter is clearly an indication that he doesn't agree with the 1965 Voting Rights Act. So how much do you think, Joyce Vance, that Roy Moore is a kind of unreconstructed racist?
Well, I wouldn't want to pass on anyone else's views in that area. I think what's safe to say is that Moore is not a supporter of the Voting Rights Act, which is, of course, incredibly important in ensuring that everyone in our community who's entitled to can exercise their right to vote. He is on record in a 2011 interview stating that he believes that everything in the amendments to the United States Constitution after the original Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, is unnecessary. And that would, of course, include voting rights for African Americans and voting rights for women. So he has, I think, made clear what his views are in that area.
Well, is he a theocrat?
You know, again, Moore expresses a clear, compelling, to his own mind, to his own way of thinking, point of view, that God's law trumps the United States. And that is, of course, contrary to the rule of law, contrary to every oath that we take as public servants in this country to uphold the Constitution. Alabama's senior Senator Richard Shelby gave an interview earlier this week where he said that one of the reasons he could not support Moore was because of his failure to support the rule of law. That's a really important sticking point down here, because you hear many people in Alabama expressing support for Moore's view that it's okay for Moore to violate the law because God's law, which Moore knows, is more important than the laws of the United States. And that, of course, would make it very difficult for someone to take their oath as a senator and uphold the Constitution. Having gone on record and been removed from the Alabama Supreme Court twice for violating that oath.
Well, is that why Senator Shelby on Sunday said we can do better than Roy Moore, and said he was going to vote for a write-in? I don't think he said who he was going to write in, but he's going to write in somebody. And also Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, has made it clear that he doesn't want Roy Moore in the Senate. Is that to do with the way the Senate operates? Because my fear is that if you have a theocrat like Roy Moore, who's demonstrated his disregard for the rule of law, the Senate is a place where just one U.S. senator can basically grind the place to a halt.
You know, the Senate as an entity really depends upon collaboration among its members to get anything accomplished. We see that in practice in these last few years. Moore is not someone who's known for collaboration. He is someone who likes to give orders and have them followed. And so that's really in sharp opposition to Jones, who has indicated throughout this campaign that he intends to reach across the aisle. He has a strong track record from his time as U.S. attorney of being able to work with people in the other political party. And so there's a very sharp contrast for Alabama voters in terms of how these two would function in the Senate. I think Senator Shelby, when he made his comments, talked a little bit about that, about his concerns about lack of collegiality and willingness to work with others, but also was quick to say that he was concerned about the message that a Moore victory would send for the business environment, as well as for the rule of law type issues that are so important here.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Joyce Vance, what do you think is going on with Stephen Bannon, who's championed Roy Moore's candidacy, still apparently communicates with Trump regularly, might well have gotten Trump to do robocalls and do that rally down there in Pensacola and go all out for Roy Moore? His choices have been pretty bizarre. There's Chemtrails Kelly in Arizona, a convicted felon in upstate New York, Frost to Freeze. Mitch McConnell said, you know, that this is a guy that picks losing candidates. If Roy Moore wins, isn't it going to be a massive victory for Stephen Bannon and everything that he stands for?
So Moore seems to be Bannon's creature at this point. Bannon has been on the campaign trail with him at a slew of rallies and events, is with him today in Midland. But Moore is campaigning in places that you don't usually see Alabama Republicans. And so he and Bannon are out looking for support in places like Walker County, in places like Dora, Alabama, where Moore is seeking to appeal to voters who he believes are in his base. But they're staying away from places that Republicans usually draw strong support, the wealthy suburbs in Birmingham, and other large cities where business interests and concerns predominate. Bannon has certainly been successful in seeing his candidates elected, starting with the president. I think we'll have to wait until tomorrow to find out if Alabama voters are willing to listen to an outside strategist over a proven Alabama law enforcement figure.
Well, it's hard to understand what's going on in the country in general. And I know you're a regular on MSNBC, continuing being asked about what's going on with the Mueller probe. My sense is that the signals that we're getting from the White House and from the White House lawyers indicate they keep saying as though there's an artificial deadline at the end of the year for Mueller to wrap up his investigation. That strikes me as possibly an artificial deadline that they are creating at the White House in order to say, well, he hasn't finished up and we're going to can him. And you can see that Rupert Murdoch, who speaks with Trump every day, I'm told, his Fox News are beginning a kind of jihad, an organized campaign to delegitimize this Vietnam War hero, former Marine Republican who served honorably for both Republican and Democratic administrations. And nobody's ever questioned his integrity until now. But you've got people like Sean Hannity saying the most outrageous things about him as though he's the devil incarnate. So to my sense, the sliming of Robert Mueller is just beginning.
Well, you know, when the special counsel appointment was made to Mueller, it did not come with any sort of a deadline. I don't think Mueller will feel compelled to stick to an artificial deadline. And as you, I think, correctly point out, Mueller has been in government service for decades. He has been typically appointed by the Republican Party, but he is respected by Democrats as well. If Mueller were to be fired, I think that we would be looking at a serious constitutional crisis, and I would hope that the lions of the Senate and up in the House would come forward to support the rule of law.
Well, just in closing, though, if Roy Moore wins, will that be a blow to all the decent people of goodwill in this country that believe in justice and truth and the American way, the idea that a child molester, a theocrat, a man who is going to probably grind the Senate to a halt, is elected over a guy that you know who's been a champion of law and order and decency, and he's been a fighter for regular folks?
Well, I'm counting on the good people of Alabama to make conscientious decisions when they vote tomorrow. They have a stark contrast. There are issues that are important to people in Alabama on both sides of this race. But again, you know, we started talking about the fact that people don't really come in one-size-fits-all packaging, and people are complex and they're individuals. People in Alabama want to see their children grow up and live good lives, and tomorrow's election will be about what that future will look like.
Well, Joyce White-Vance, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Joyce White-Vance, who's a distinguished visiting lecturer in law at the University of Alabama School of Law. She served as the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Alabama for 8 years under Barack Obama, and prior to that served as an Assistant United States Attorney in Birmingham, Alabama, for 18 years. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into reports that Eric Prince and Oliver North are lobbying the White House to set up a private sector off-the-books alternative to the CIA as a way around what Donald Trump sees as the deep state that is out to get him.
You've been born with white skin, they explain, and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain. As he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, but it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in their game.
But they beg you, wave my name. I got one hell of a job, we're born for the U.S. of A. Got the responsibility of our nation's top security. But every night and day, I salute the flag and say, thank you, Jesus, because I'm a secret agent.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Young Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
Hi.
So, Robert, I just learned that the lawsuit that you had against Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, that's been in the courts for some time, I take it that the jury in Virginia, where Eric Prince lives, ruled against you.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate because you deal with seven people who can only deal with the statements made by the people under oath in court. So I think sometime in March we'll be asking the judge for sanctions and to overturn the verdict because of a number of statements made by Eric Prince while under oath.
Mm-hmm. Meaning what? Did he lie under oath?
When you read the transcript, I think it'll be self-evident, but mm-hmm. he didn't want to be associated with the Somalia project, mm-hmm. Most likely due to the fact that it violated ITAR rules and the UN arms embargo. Mm-hmm. So he was very vociferous about his lack of connection to that, even though the data showed that he was directly connected and his tax return showed that he had a direct hand in it. So, I mean, these are things that people make decisions in court to do, but they have consequences in the long run.
Mm-hmm. But essentially, you sued him. I thought you sued him over an autobiography he commissioned you to do, and then he turned around and decided to make his own deal with the publisher. And then he countersued you, right?
Yeah, well, Eric didn't want me to talk about what was in the original book. So his goal was to basically silence me, and I refused to sign a, I don't know what they call it, a secrecy or a NDA or something. But the bottom line is that, you know, Eric came to me in 2010, and I did an interview with him for Men's Journal. He came to me to help me in the Somalia project, which I did, and he came to me to help him protect the Blackwater brand, which I did, and he came to me to help me fix his autobiography, which nobody would publish. So I got him a publishing deal with Adrian Zakheim, and then he turned around and made his own deal with Adrian and then sued me because he forgot that I was the only guy that knew what was in the original book. So, I mean, that's what you get for doing business with Eric. But, you know, the bottom line is that we feel strongly that the statements he made he didn't present much evidence because we presented all the documents, will lead to a sanction and a reversal.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine, has had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi rebel and insurgent groups. His books include License to Kill, Hired Guns, In the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. So, Robert Young-Pelton, the fact that you've had long dealings with Eric Prince is the reason why I was calling you, because The Intercept recently published a report saying that Eric Prince, along with Oliver North, have pitched this idea of an alternative CIA to Mike Pompeo, the head of the CIA, and to the White House, and that it's gotten an encouraging reception. That's what you hear from some quarters. They, of course, are denying it. The NSC spokesman said nothing's happening. But some of my sources tell me that this private CIA of Eric Prince's and Oliver North's is well underway, and that the CIA veteran John McGuire is very actively involved in it. So what do you know about this?
Well, it's interesting because John McGuire was the guy that wrote the letter for Eric, the get-out-of-jail letter to Eric, when five weapons were handed over to the King of Jordans at the Blackwater facility in March of 2005, but he didn't write that letter until 2012. And John McGuire was also one of the Iran-Contra trainers when he worked for the CIA, so they have a long history. And, you know, what you're seeing right now is Eric is machine-gunning ideas into the Trump administration. You know, not just this, but also aviation packages, mining ideas, et cetera, et cetera. And they're being met with mixed receptions because, you know, first of all, when you're doing deals like this, like a secret, off-the-books spy organization, to have it published on the front page of all the news organizations is probably not a good sign. And then secondly, I don't think it's the Bush administration. I don't think Dick Cheney is his top cover anymore. So I think people are a little bit more concerned about, you know, the track record of what happens when you deal with these covert things and they go very, very wrong. And Iran-Contra is the perfect example.
Well, Oliver North is nevertheless a part of the package. And Pompeo shows signs of being a bit of a buccaneer, doesn't he? I mean, the fact that Trump got him to talk to a NSA dissident who has this screwy idea that the DNC hack was not done by the Russians but was done by a U.S. intelligence insider, that's not a good sign. So I wouldn't be surprised.
What you're picking up on is this paranoia about deep state. And what the concept is that there are a number of Obama appointees or people who obviously are disposed to support, you know, the Democratic agenda, who are eagerly, you know, exposing things like meetings in the Seychelles, and whether that's a FISA, you know, event or whether it's just bad security, you're seeing a lot of aggressive exposure of clandestine, covert, and sort of secretive activities. And people are trying to convince members of the Trump administration, including Donald Trump Jr., that there is a conspiracy inside the intelligence agencies themselves to expose Trump and his followers. And so there was one story about the tinfoil room at the Trump Tower, in which they were showing covert devices used to surveil people and telling people that we need to stop the surveillance and we need to set up our own counter-surveillance organization. So it's a very weird conspiratorial type of, almost a Watergate type of mindset in D.C. right now.
Well, Donald Trump has come up with all the craziest conspiracies, not the least of which is the birth of one, and he talks with Alex Jones and regularly reads Alex Jones' InfoWars. So he's susceptible to the craziest stuff. Isn't that clear?
Yeah, so you have two camps. I mean, you have people that have worked within the CIA and the FBI and other law enforcement organizations who see real connections between, you know, shady players and these new sort of camp followers that hang around Trump Tower. And then you have people in power who really don't care what the media says or what the facts say or what, you know, the population is concerned about. So we're seeing a division down the middle where it's hard to tell who's telling the truth and who's setting up a conspiratorial attack or whether this is all just rumor.
So then what do you think is going on here? Because there's no question that Maguire, the former CIA guy, has had dealings with Eric Prince, particularly through the Hong Kong company, that Frontier Services Group, that largely work for the Chinese government. Prince also has an operation in the Emirates where he has a private army. He could actually start a war in the Middle East. He's got the assets to do so. He did meet in the Seychelles with MBZ, who's a big player. He's basically the mentor of MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. So what's going on here? Is it this because of this loose, conspiratorial-minded administration where all kinds of people can wander in and whisper crazy stuff in Trump's ear, although apparently the General Kelly tried to slow that down a little bit, having fired the bodyguard.
Yeah.
Still, what's going on? Is this just a bunch of camp followers, as you described them, trying to make a buck out of this extremely loose arrangement between governance and private interests known as the Trump administration?
No, I'll tell you exactly what's going on. The Trump administration wants a war with Iran, and they want a proxy war in which what they call the GCC, or the Gulf Nations, along with Israel, starts hammering away at Hezbollah in places like Lebanon and Syria. And then they want to accelerate that into sort of a Gaddafi-type overthrow of the Iranian government. And they're looking to start this war with sort of deniable freelancers. And, of course, if you can imagine the New York Times story about the Reflex Response Army, in which the UAE engaged Eric Prince to bring in Colombians and set up an entire support network for a private army, this was part of that movement where if we have a proxy begin hostilities with Iran, then we can accuse Iran of attacking Israel, attacking the West, and then we just accelerate it from there. So this is already happening. As you know, Israel bombed Hezbollah in Syria and made it very public. And you have to ask yourself, why is that the case? You know, we just recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. So there are clear steps towards a bellicose position against Iran.
Right, but the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital really hung the Saudis out to dry and has really helped the Iranians with the Arab Street.
Yes, but this is part of the Washington view of how things have to be in the future. And if you go back to the Iran-Contra days and you go back to Ali North and the whole view of the Middle East in which we had enemies and the whole Dick Cheney office of planning in which we had to start a war, and if you remember the John Maguire, just after 9/11 was training up Iraqis to go into Iraq to start a fake war. I mean, these things all click into play. So this is not a fantasy. This is actually being promoted in Washington.
So then what do the generals think about it? We're told that Mattis, Kelly, and McMaster, even though none of them have any affection for Iran, they're trying to restrain the Eric Princes and the other gung-ho types.
And Steve Bannon. Don't forget the Steve Bannon.
Right, Steve Bannon.
These are men who have lost men and friends in war, and they're not going to make rash decisions. But they don't ultimately control the viewpoint of the president, and they don't necessarily rein in the activities of these camp followers who are coming up with all kinds of wacky ideas and seriously looking for private funding to do these things. So, I mean, we have to keep the eye on the ball here, that we have the same problem we had during the WMD crisis, where we have neocons pushing an agenda, not necessarily related to what America wants to do, because they have their own belief of how the Middle East needs to shake out and what America needs to do. So that's where these stories are bubbling up from. And you have to ask yourself why these are being exposed. I mean, you know, why are we reading all these stories about Eric Prince? And, you know, in the media in the last 2 or 3 weeks, and they all seem to relate to, I won't say covert, but I mean sort of privatized ideas on how to fight wars. And we're looking for proxies and people to conduct a specific agenda. And why is Steve Bannon, you know, banging the gavel and traveling around the world to China and the UAE having meetings?
Well, you know, if Steve Bannon's choices of candidates to run, like Roy Moore and Chemtrails Kelly in Arizona, and the convicted felon in upstate New York. If those are his choices politically for candidates, God help us for his choices for who to go to war against.
Yeah, but be careful. These are carefully designed sort of IEDs put into the political landscape. You know, he's showing, it's Roy Moore, you know, he survived that media assault and the accusations of improper behavior, and he's running for office. Now, think about that. I mean, not many people can survive that kind of blistering attack. You know, he's suggesting that Eric Prince is going to run in Wyoming. Eric Prince has never lived in Wyoming, so he's essentially throwing grenades into the political system, and we're laughing at it, but then watch what happens with Roy Moore.
Right, and Roy Moore alone could cripple the United States Senate.
So there you go. So these are very carefully calculated landmines placed into the political landscape, and we're seeing a new paradigm in political gerrymandering. We're seeing the press being sort of ridiculed and sort of almost like a Leninist approach where it doesn't matter what the media thinks, it doesn't matter what the public thinks. We know how to game the system, and that system is going to be gamed for an agenda that we don't quite reveal yet, but in, you know, 2 or 3 months, we will see our very bellicose approach to the world.
Well, I think within a couple of months, Trump's going to try and fire the special prosecutor. I think that's absolutely, they're signaling that so clearly. And now Fox News has launched their slime campaign to delegitimize Mueller and attack this Vietnam War hero, Republican, bipartisan, highly admired person. And they're saying the most scurrilous things about him. So that ship's already sailed. So it's just a matter of time before I think we have some kind of a constitutional crisis, don't you think?
But watch the Soviet-style engineering of public shaming, you know, the use of, you know, long lists of people who accuse politicians, of people who may not be a Weinstein or a, you know, Woody Allen or whatever, but suddenly getting torpedoed. And this is what you're seeing. It's a very Soviet concept of marginalizing people and pushing their way into the political spectrum. And at the same time, you know, if you looked at Eric Prince's presentation on Afghanistan, monetizing warfare. In other words, saying, oh, let's, here's a gunship and this and that. And, oh, look how much money there is in this province.
Right.
As if somehow that was a prize. So this is the new reality of the Trump political landscape. So, monetizing warfare.
Right. Monetizing warfare and playing this kind of Roy Cohn style of politics, after all, Roy Cohn being Trump's mentor.
Exactly.
So when you say, you know, suddenly politicians get slimed, I mean, it did strike me as being a little odd that Al Franken, suddenly a very promising, rising Democratic star, is suddenly out of business. And
well, he's baffled, but I think what you'll find is there's going to be a story in the next month or so that'll lay the plan to get rid of these people. Al Franken was a comedian on a USO tour doing raunchy things. I wouldn't call it rape, and I wouldn't call it sexual harassment. It was just very well structured at the right time to take him out. And this is very Soviet. You know, this is the type of thing the Soviets used to do to marginalize candidates.
Right.
So this idea that truth doesn't matter, manipulating the media, insulting the media, ridiculing the media as a whole, so that people don't know who to believe, so that, you know, Trump's tweets suddenly have the same veracity as the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. This is bizarro world, right?
Well, this is what they borrowed from Putin. This is the world that Putin's so-called political technologist Surkov developed. You know, this is the world that Bannon has brought from Putin. So, no, it's an extraordinary situation. This is a very scary time, and this is this is the tyranny of the minority. These people only have 35...
Pay attention to these stories. I mean,
yeah.
I would suggest that people pay attention to these stories, which may not hit dead center because they're attacking camp followers, or they're sort of bringing up, you know, things, proposals, ideas, people who are on the Trump, you know, breadcrumb trail, but aren't in the center of things. And this is what Trump is doing. He's allowing people on the sidelines to push these plans forward and monetize foreign policy and watch them slide into actual contracts and events. So it's a very dangerous time because we don't have accountability. We don't have a full understanding of what Donald Trump does every day, other than drink Pepsis and watch TV. So we have people like Steve Bannon who are literally outside of government pushing a certain agenda. And we have people like Dick Cheney pushing an agenda. I mean, the old Bush administration, WMD people, want to go after Iran bad.
Right. Well, and you also got Jared Kushner with his best friend MBS shaking down the Qataris royals for $500 million for his underwater building. I mean, the mixture between Trump and the family's business and foreign policy is extraordinary. It's never happened before where being elected to the White House, and not that he was really elected, but ending up in the White House is a ticket to increase your brand and shake down foreign potentates for money. What a deal.
Right. So they're attacking Mueller because he's focused on getting testimony, evidence, trying to sort out what the, you know, the Russia thing is, and he's getting closer and closer. Now, I'm not saying that the Russians made Hillary Clinton win the popular vote and then lose it because of the Electoral College, but I'm just saying that when responsible adults inject themselves into the White House, whether it be Kelly or Mattis or people like that, they're going to be starting to be pushed out now.
Right. Well, we, you know, Pompeo is likely to be Secretary of State, and then Tom Cotton, God help us, the head of the CIA. So it gets worse. It doesn't get better. Yeah. No, I agree.
Exactly.
Well, look, let's do a follow-up on this. We'll talk soon, I hope.
Yeah, read those articles, pay attention to them, because they're based on fact, even though they don't seem to hit the center point of what's going on in the media.
Which articles are you talking about?
I'm talking about people like The Intercept or BuzzFeed, who are not necessarily looked at as being, you know, mainstream media, but they're digging hard. It's enterprise.
Oh, I know,
talking to people.
Yeah. No, I talked to some sources of mine that said that this story that The Intercept's come up with is much bigger than even they have. So, no, I'm going to stay on top of it. I thank you for joining us, Robert Young-Pelton.
Thank you, Ian. Always a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's a publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurous. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with a Bangladeshi-American lawyer about how the attempted suicide bombing in New York by a Bangladeshi immigrant might impact the Bangladeshi community.
Bandanas, FBI spying on us through the radio antennas, and I'm hitting cameras in the streetlight watching society with no respect for the people's right to privacy. I want to be free to live, able to have what I need to live, bring the power back to the street where the people live. We sick of working for crumbs and filling up the prisons, dying over money and relying on religion for help. Hey, can you relate? We living in a
no more bondage, no more political monsters, no more secrets.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Chamtoli Huck, who's a Bangladeshi-American lawyer with Law at the Margins in New York City, a nonprofit that addresses human rights issues in the U.S. and globally. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chamtoli Huck.
Thank you. Welcome.
And you represent a lot of members of the Bangladeshi community in New York, and has this person that's apparently tried to set off a pipe bomb strapped to his body in the morning rush hour today in one of Manhattan's busiest commuter corridors, the subway tunnel just off Times Square, where the Port Authority bus terminal is. He set off this pipe bomb strapped to his body. He's been injured. Four other people were lightly injured. And Khaled Ullah, is that how you pronounce his name?
I believe so. I don't know how to pronounce the first, but Ullah is a very kind of common surname.
Right. and he lived in Brooklyn. So is this in any way resonating in the Bangladeshi community in New York? Does anybody know this perpetrator?
Well, I think a lot of the story of the individual bomber is still kind of unfolding. We do know that he's from the Brooklyn area, but it has had already a big impact in the Bangladeshi immigrant community. So the Bangladeshi community is actually one of the fastest growing communities in New York City and in all parts of the city, but it's also large communities outside of New York, in New Jersey and Detroit, Michigan, and Los Angeles. So I think part of the concern is now that, you know, Bangladesh was not listed among the countries in the travel ban, or human rights activists call it a Muslim ban, because it's very much targeting people from Muslim countries. So people, our community members are really concerned whether this incident will lead to increased one surveillance in the community. Because that's happened before, and also hate crimes, because, you know, the Kensington community is a very, you know, dense insular community in Brooklyn. So there's a lot of really anxiety on the ground from the community in terms of the impact that it will have. And also we're, you know, the question I'm going to push back a little bit, because media wants to know, do you know this person? But we have to be careful that once you identify someone as knowing the suspect, you also identify that person as a potential witness and also open to interrogation. So I, you know, we've been also trying to ask, tell the media to be sensitive of not just pulling random people, which we've been hearing reports of, and saying, do you know this person? Because that can expose that those community members to, you know, to risk, right? Because they then become part of the investigation. So we are focusing more on the impact on the community. We're urging community members to just really consult lawyers before interactions with the law enforcement. You know, the current climate, just as it is in Trump administration, is already worrisome for the community, and this just adds another layer of concern.
Well, I think the question arises about, you know, whether the person was known in the community, is because the counterintuitive part of what Donald Trump is doing in terms of his Muslim ban, and for example, he recently spoke in Suffolk County, New York, to a bunch of sheriffs. And you might recall where he said, basically said, told the cops to rough up suspect and don't be so nice to them and put your hand on the head when you put him in the back of the car. And that was all done in the context of a speech he made about MS-13 and going after this gang. And shortly thereafter, a high-ranking member of MSN-13 went on television disguised and said the best thing that's ever happened to MS-13 is Donald Trump, because he's demonized the Latino community to the extent that they don't cooperate with the police anymore, and therefore they've given MSN-13 gang basically free rein. So that is what going on with Trump, and the same extends to the Muslim community. If you demonize the Muslims, then they're not going to cooperate with you in terms of law enforcement and understanding whether there's somebody in the midst of a community that is being radicalized. So those are the questions that arise. So, you know, you can make the argument that Donald Trump himself, his policies are actually helping terrorists, because they don't encourage communities to basically, you know, say so-and-so is on a radical path. Mm-hmm. I mean, so
no,
how?
Sure. I mean, I think, no, that's absolutely, I understand the position of how his position might, you know, create the fear in the community. We're now at the today responding to the community's fears about how it would impact even more with Donald Trump, or would be aggressive policies. There are community members who have immigration applications pending, will they be subject to greater scrutiny? There are, news reports, not yet fully verified, but that he entered through family member, application. Will that program of family unification immigration be impacted? So right now, the community's main concern, one is, is just to be safe, right? Because you also have to keep in mind, this Bangladeshi community, one-third tend to be in working jobs as drivers, in vendors. There's in the subway, there are newspaper vendors. And so many of the people who are newspaper vendors are Bangladeshi. So they're just as much impacted by this bomb. And so they're now also worrying about how their security in terms of immigration, hate crimes increased sort of after Trump's election. There was an imam who was killed. So there's just a sort of anxiety right now in terms of safety, and that's really the foremost worry and concern that we have. What you're raising are just kind of more broader issues about, does this hurt or harm? Does this radicalize? Right now the community's concern is primarily around safety and what could come down the pike in terms of changed laws.
And in general, then, is there, you mentioned that there was a, he may well have gotten, I guess, some kind of a green card entry into the United States via relatives. Is that what you know about him so far? Has anything emerged about his extended family, if there is indeed one?
Yeah, what the media is reporting is that he's a permanent resident. A permanent resident is colloquially we understand as a green card holder.
Mm-hmm.
He's been here, he would then after five years then can apply for citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
So there is also concern that community members who are making the next step to become citizens, their applications for citizenship, U.S. citizenship, might get scrutinized. The immigration law is very complicated. There's different ways in which family members can sponsor and apply, and depending on your proximity, if you're an immediate family member, spouse, children, there are particular ways where you can, under family reunification programs, bring family members here. It's still not clear to me from the media whether that is how he came to the United States. But I think it would be, we should just be really cautious about part of, if you go on Twitter, a lot of the Trump supporters are saying, yeah, we should sort of stop all of these immigration programs, right? All of this feeds into the frenzy, and casting kind of this doubt on all sort of hardworking Bangladeshi immigrants who are in the United States, myself included. I'm not born in the United States. I'm a naturalized citizen in New York City. I grew up in this immigrant Bangladeshi community. So I just want us to be careful, before we really have all the facts to draw these links, because they're going to be used to say we should restrict migration from Bangladesh. We should, curtail some of the programs regarding family reunification. We should add Bangladesh to the Muslim ban. All those would be really dangerous propositions to kind of go forward. So far, all we know is that he's sort of that lone wolf. The community is sort of shocked and surprised. It's kind of, they're sort of, shocked by this sort of incident. So they're still also trying to figure it out as well, of how this could happen. But I'd be cautious to kind of generalize it to some sort of increased radicalism in New York City or to links to groups in Bangladesh. It is true there is incidents in Bangladesh that ISIS has claimed, but there's nothing yet that connects Akhilullah to those folks in Bangladesh.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, you mentioned, Chumtali Haque, that you were advising the community, the Bangladeshi community, to seek legal counsel before speaking to law enforcement. Does that, you're not suggesting that they don't cooperate with law enforcement, surely. What exactly are you saying?
Well, I think the Bangladeshi community, unfortunately, has experienced post 9/11 instances where racial profiling has led to arrests or, charges. There's actually someone who is currently in prison, Ehsanul Sadiqi, who was just a young guy who may have, spurted something, some things regarding Islam on the internet to friends, as because of those statements, has been sort of in prison because considered to be kind of a radical terrorist. So what I'm now, because of all of this concern of who's the suspect, who knew the suspect, how are young people, are they being radicalized? My concern is that in the zealousness to find that, innocent people without counsel may make statements that may be just misconstrued. And so they should make statements with advice of counsel. I was a lawyer, in post 9/11, and I worked for a number of community groups. So this is from personal experience. I'm not saying people not to cooperate if they have information that would lead to investigation, but the way that the law enforcement and also approach community members oftentimes can expose those members to increased scrutiny, surveillance, and so they should know the pros and cons and make their decision accordingly. So that's my message really for the community members, is to know their rights in their interactions with the law enforcement. And after that, it's really up to them. I can't tell them to speak or not to speak. I can just say, these are your rights in interacting, and these are the pros and cons of interacting with law enforcement.
Well, Chumtali Haque, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Chumtali Haque, who's a Bangladeshi-American lawyer with Law at the Margins in New York City, a nonprofit that addresses human rights issues in the U.S. and globally. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.